it really is coming from people, health workers, wanting to just make their voices heard and make the voices of residents heard. It's not making their voice heard. It's amplifying the voices of people in Gaza who are being silenced, the children of Gaza who are being silenced, the human beings in Gaza who are being silenced, because no one should be silenced.
Yeah.
And they are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They are, I would say, they are superhuman beings.
Yeah.
They are, really are, because I don't think any other nation on earth, any other people would have tolerated what they have tolerated, and yet would smile and say Alhamdulillah, or, you know, kind of when you pick up the phone and call them, they don't even, they just like, we can't complain, like, yeah. Alhamdulillah.
Welcome to season 2 of Third Culture Therapy, a podcast that sits at the intersection of mental health and culture and explores the unique ways our different social identities and cultural backgrounds impact our mental and emotional well-being. Really happy to have on the show today Dr. Ahmad Abdelmanan. Thank you so much for coming and joining. I'm really excited to be speaking to you today. I say excited, I'm also quite, it's more I'm very intrigued by all of the things that you are going to reveal about yourself. I know you in a personal capacity, but there's so much about you that I don't know and so much that I think our listeners would love to learn about you. But first, a brief introduction. Dr. Ahmad, you are British, but also Egyptian. You're Egyptian born. You lived there for the first 8 years of your life until your family relocated to the UK, Scotland, and across the UK. You're a pediatric neurologist, and you work at Great Ormond Street. You studied at Oxford University. You also are something of a humanitarian, having visited the West Bank and Gaza for several years through a sponsored program with the Medical Aid for Palestinians, and had these links with training and educating in Gaza, especially for many years, which as a result of that put you at the forefront of sort of connection with the medical sphere there during this current and ongoing, as of our recording today, currently still ongoing onslaught on Gaza. And as a result, you created a social media account, Gaza Medic Voices, over 90,000 followers and counting, to basically put out into the world what it was that you were seeing and witnessing from on the ground there. And as a result of that, you've gone on to make several media appearances. You are prolific across all of UK TV, news, radio channels. And you've also been leading vigils and talking in Parliament and so many amazing things that you've been doing in order to bring out the voice of healthcare workers and in Gaza. You're also an entrepreneur with your own telehealth company. You have a lot of feathers in your bow. You have a lot of ways in which we could describe you, a lot of characteristics. And my first question to you is, which of these characteristics do you most strongly identify with? You know, entrepreneur, doctor, humanitarian, Egyptian, British, you name it, you pick it. You're also a father mm-hmm. and a husband. Which of these identities do you most strongly align with?
So first of all, I'm very excited to be here. I've been waiting to be here for a long time. So thank you for this opportunity. And thank you for the really kind introduction. It's quite humbling to, you know, be told these things. And in terms of my main identity, I think first and foremost, I would say that it's difficult. I think as a doctor and a humanitarian in that sphere, that's very much my professional hat on. But when you ask me what's your identity, I identify as British Egyptian, ethnically and from a nationality perspective, and Muslim as well, and Arab, because I think what has taught me in this period of time and over the last 10 years is actually, you know, these borders that were drawn up essentially by the British Empire, like, really don't mean that much. Like, we are all very much one and the same. And that is something that I think has led me to this situation now, where I identify more as a humanitarian doctor than even as a, you know, a nationality or a specific ethnicity as such.
And you work as a humanitarian doctor has meant being subjected to, or at least, you know, being exposed to, particularly now, you know, and for context for those listening who aren't, you know, completely clued up, as of the date of recording, Gaza is under bombardment, has been for over 2 months, with more than, far in excess, really, of 20,000 casualties. People have been killed by bombs, and half of those being children. And that's not even to talk about those who are injured, which are in the tens of thousands. And of course, as a result of the siege and the, well, almost, I would say, near destruction of the healthcare system, we're anticipating seeing many more people dying. And you, in your work, I mean, first of all, maybe you could talk to us about how you came to it. But I guess my question in relation to what we are here to discuss, and that's mental and emotional well-being, you know, you have been exposed to a lot of imagery, unfiltered and constant for over 2 months now. And you've had to absorb that, but also not only absorb it, digest it, and then reproduce it and share it out to the world as part of your advocacy, as part of your humanitarian work. How has that impacted you on a personal level?
So I think to answer that, I think it's important to just give the context. So 76 days now we are entering of this onslaught and massacre and genocide, frankly. It is not a war, and I refuse to use the word war in here because it is so one-sided. I'll be honest here in that I was very much at the forefront initially with Gaza Medic Voices, which, for those who don't know, is a social media platform that was set up based on our very deep-rooted connections with healthcare workers on the ground in Gaza. And we were receiving even messages and photos and videos and unfiltered, truly unfiltered, raw stuff that, you know, I wish no human would need to see. And we were receiving this and we were looking at the news, and it was like a dystopian Black Mirror episode. On the news, it was Israel's at war, Israel's getting attacked, Israel onslaught. And then, like, my phone is showing me these pictures of, like, people literally being annihilated and massacred and children being mutilated. I just thought, this is not right.
By people, you mean Palestinians?
Palestinians, yeah, Gazans, human beings. And so we felt very strongly, and this, when I say we, I'm talking about the team of doctors that have been going out to Gaza since 2011 to teach and train medical students. So we are a very close-knit community, mostly based in Oxford, with a couple of Londoners and some international colleagues. And we started meeting, you know, from the 7th of October, like the day after we met, to discuss what we think is going to happen and how can we respond, because we knew it was coming. And then on the 10th of October, like, we were receiving these messages, and we basically sat down and decided, a small group, working group of us, three of us, the kind of younger crew who are more social media savvy, and said, let's set this up. And, you know, we had lots of iterations, and then eventually someone, I think it was me and Tanya, basically said, oh, Gaza Medic Voices. And then it just kind of came about. And so what we were getting in that was, like I said, very unfiltered raw footage. And initially I was part of the team that was looking through that footage and filtering and deciding what gets used, what doesn't. But it had a massive emotional toll on me, on Tanya, on Rebecca, the three of us, and the team that's quickly formed. So we have like a team of volunteers now that looks through this material. It's not a one-man show or one-woman show. It is very much a team. And I'll stress this. This whole thing is a team. Every time, there is no one individual who's key here. It is all about the entourage that you have. And I very quickly noticed that I was becoming desensitized to this stuff. So I was very numb. I would see like pictures and it just wouldn't really hit, like it just wouldn't have the reaction that I should be having. And I wasn't aware of that. The first time I became aware was I think 2 weeks in. So 2 weeks into this conflict, I remember sitting at home with my wife. She just brought up her phone, and the irony is all the stuff that I'd seen on my own page hadn't got to me. But she decided to show me something from Twitter from a journalist who basically had just tweeted this, and it was actually from her brother. My brother-in-law sent her a message saying, show this to any who basically says, you know, Israel that is has a right to self-defense. That was his like message. So he showed me this video and I started watching and I didn't know what I was watching. So I was taken by surprise. But it was basically rolling footage from one of the cameramen literally at the front entrance of Al-Shifa Hospital with an ambulance coming in and kids just streaming in. And he's running like, you know, kind of cameraman style filming, and he's moving in the room, and you can see the ER is completely chock-a-block with people. And on this bed, there's a kid literally there with his stomach out of his abdomen. Literally, his stomach is like because of the wound that he's, the shrapnel wound that has led to it. And you can just see it straight away. And then the camera moves and you see another kid with third degree burns from their face down, literally being like sprayed with water. And I'm sorry, this is very graphic, but this is what I was seeing.
Yeah.
And then I can't even remember, like at this point, just literally all that emotion that I think I just pent up and all that, you know, kind of pretending like I was okay just came out, and I just started sobbing. Like it wasn't even crying. It was like wailing, sobbing. And it was just so primal. And I found it very difficult to stop that. Like, I think it took me half an hour to basically calm down. And I hadn't had that reaction up. I hadn't shed a single tear up until then,
wow.
which I think was a reflection of a negative emotional cycle that I was going through and a sort of reluctance to basically talk about what I was seeing. So that triggered like a very quick, and I'm very attuned to my own mental health because of some of my mental health struggles, which I'm sure we'll touch upon at some point. But, you know, I became very attuned that this is not a positive, this is a negative reaction. This is a negative cycle. Mm. It needs to be broken. So quite quickly by chance, I actually had been approached by one of my colleagues, senior colleagues in that team.
Mm.
And she reached out to myself, Rebecca and Tania. Rebecca and Tania are the other co-founders of Guards Medical Voice, Tania Hatch Hassan, Rebecca Inglis, amazing women, amazing doctors. And she said to us, you guys are like at the forefront of this information war and you're seeing all this stuff. You need to speak to a psychotherapist and you need to speak to like a psychologist who deals with PTSD, even if it's just a one-off session, just to understand, you know, what you need to be doing. I reached out to this lady who's a PTSD psychologist who's worked with veterans of war, worked with women who've been sexually abused and women who have been domestically abused and, you know, has seen the most heinous of like crimes from humanity. And she called me and was just had like a human conversation. How are you? Like, what's going on? And I told her, and I told, gave her my background, told her about this reaction that I had. And she, what she said to me, which I still remember like very vividly, I was standing outside Oxford, the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. I was doing some research there at that, on that day, and I was walking back to my car. And she said to me, the first thing I need to tell you is what happened is completely normal.
Yeah.
Like for you to react that way, that is normal.
Yeah.
It is abnormal if you don't react that way. If you just like continue to be desensitized, then that is abnormal. So it is okay to do that. And then she gave some advice, which I've been following since. So the first one was, don't expose yourself to material that you're not going to use. So unless you're doing this for the purpose of I'm going to disseminate this, don't just scroll through Insta and just like look through stuff that is going to haunt you at night. And if you come across anything that is extremely upsetting, the first thing you need to do is either pick up the phone and call a friend, call your mum, call your dad, call your wife, call, not my daughter, she's seven, I wouldn't call her, but like, you know, call anyone and talk them through exactly what you saw. Because even if it's horrific, and when I was describing to you, you know, you could see your reaction like you were inhaling, but you didn't watch it. So for you, it's not going to be the same visceral reaction as me watching it. So it's that letting go of it. And if there's no one to talk to, then you write it down and you write like a proper diary and you say how it made you feel and you say what you saw and you describe it there and then. And what's funny is I said to her, that is amazing because I've kind of done this without you telling me, because the day before I was asked by the I newspaper in the UK, which is like an independent, I think kind of a bit like the Times or the Independent. And they basically asked me to write a piece on Gaza. And I described exactly what I just told you. I described my visceral reaction to this. And I just wrote it as an article when it was published. And I remember after I wrote it, I felt this like cathartic sort of feeling of like relief. Like, wow, I've just got this out and it's on paper and it's there. And it's permanent, but it's there and I know it's okay. And that was therapeutic in itself. So so those two pieces of advice I've kind of been following since.
That's great. I'm so glad that you found at the right moment that person who could give you the right tools to actually allow you not to stop, but to carry on, but with greater strength and awareness. And I think it is, I mean, unfortunately among humanitarians, the burnout rate is quite high. Any people who work in these very high intensity, but also very service driven professions, which we'll come on to now, including the medical profession. But there is a lot of potential for self-harm without realizing, within the guise of I'm doing good, it's very hard to then stop. Yeah. Because the association is, well, then I'm not doing what I'm meant to be doing. And but actually, I don't think it's about stopping. It is about finding these ways that you can mitigate the harm. And your point about expressing it, I think, is really, really key. When everything began, you know, a couple of months ago, and Gaza in particular, I also, like so many of us, very struck by a lot of feelings of fear and just horror. But being a writer, I did decide then to, okay, let me write. And I definitely found in that process help. It helped me process, obviously, my feelings, but more than that, it landing somewhere and it being seen was also about me and my pain being seen. Because for all of us, there are individual things that are coming up as a result of this. I mean, none of us are obviously in that direct line of fire. We know that we are not going to be killed here, but it doesn't mean that it isn't activating a lot of our own personal fears and traumas. And so having that process, having that outlet, having this discussion with you, like, I always feel that all of these bits of engagement are in order to allow us to be able to continue. It's great that you have continued to follow that. And you kind of touched on the fact that this might have a little bit to do with the fact that you are already attuned to your mental health because you have struggled with it previously. Can you just describe a little bit about what that experience was for you?
Yeah, sure. So it was essentially a mix of generalized anxiety disorder and depression. And I think it was something that I probably throughout my late teens, late 20s, I sort of ignored. And I probably oftentimes pretended like it was fine because it never reached a point where I had what I would say crippling depression, where I actually had to stop doing whatever the hell I was doing. So I remember, you know, and the way I describe it, because this description people say, and it's true, it's a black cloud. Like it's a black cloud that's hanging over you and it suddenly appears. It rears its head and it's just there. And it's just like a feeling of like, so in the past, it used to be like just the edges, you know, the things that you enjoy in life, like, I don't know, watching a movie, sitting with your friends, like eating, whatever it is, you just kind of, it's blunted. Yeah. That's the way I would describe it for me. The anxiety side, not so much. I think the anxiety was normally just me being a little bit hyperactive and just needing to get stuff done. So maybe it manifested in that way. And it, normally there's a trigger. So I'm not sure whether, you know, people have clinical depression just because they have clinical depression. It doesn't have to be triggered. But for me, it was oftentimes like, you know, a life event, something that upset me, and it would just sort of hang over for a few weeks or a few months. And I just, again, like I said, I never diagnosed itself, never self-diagnosed, never spoke to anyone. And then it really came to a head probably sort of around the time. So I'm a pediatric neurologist, I'm a clinician, so I see patients and I do clinics and I do ward rounds, and like that's my life, right? So I'm very much in constant communication with people. And I'm an only child, so I have an extra like need to talk to people and like, you know, have people around me. Like that is a need that I've had throughout my childhood. So when I decided to start doing academia and do a PhD, which in medicine is very hard to do on top of your clinical training. So what you do is you separate it. You say, right, I'm going to stop my clinical training and I'm just going to do a PhD full time. And then I'm going to jump back in when it's finished. So I was like in my second and a half to third year of a 4-year PhD, which is like standard time that most people spend out of doing their research. And doing a PhD is very lonely. Like it is so self-driven. And I'm not the best, you know, this is the truth. I'm not the most self-driven person. I need to feed off energy of others, or I need to feed off, you know, some sort of, even whether, you know, as simple as like someone praising me or someone like, you know, there's that need. So, so I found it very difficult and I struggled with that. And I don't think I realized that until like my, third year, essentially. And I was taking on too many tasks and I was trying to do too many things for too many people, research wise and life wise. And, you know, it was one of the situations where I just thought I could take it all on and on and on. And it was because I was going through a period of probably like more energy than I had before, but it came to a head. And I think it came to a head when I hadn't realized how much I had taken on board, how thin I had stretched myself. And then that realization basically led to what I would say a crippling depressive period where I basically burnt out. And it coincided with winter, which is never a good time for me anyway. And I basically got to a stage where I took 2 weeks of annual leave and I came back from annual leave. And I just walked into the, like, got on the underground and I was like, I can't go to work. Yeah. Like, I'm not right. And the first thing I did was go to see the doctor and, like, you know, spoke to him. And anyway, like, long story short, it took a good 2 months of being off work and trying to realign, like, my own mental health and to get it to a position where I felt able to look after myself before I was looking after other people. And, it, like, I think what I was saying is because of that experience and because that was a very hard 2 months, especially, and probably harder on my family than on me, because they're the ones who are affected by this. They're the ones who have to like put up with, you know, the grumpy Omar who doesn't want to do like anything. So I realized quickly that I have to be very clear about my boundaries and I have to only take on what I can take on. And I have to only work within like my own capabilities. And I also have to be very attuned and think, am I burning out or am I not burning out? That's a question like I ask myself all the time. And in this period of time, you know, despite what you've listed, and it does sound like a lot, it is a lot, but I'm always, which I wasn't before, I'm always asking myself, can I take this on or can I not take it on? And what has been most amazing about this period of time, and that has helped, so many people have reached out and so many people are basically unburdening me of some of the stuff that I technically I'm doing, but I'm not really doing.
Yeah.
I've just come up with the idea and I've got like a doer who will be like, right, I'm going to take this off your plate. I'll give you an example. So like I went to a charity dinner about 2 weeks into the conflict. I was invited to go on a table with a load of medics. It was one for medical aid Palestinians. And someone came up to me and she just said, you're Omar from TV. And I was like, God, like how embarrassing. Cause like, that's the last thing I that's the last thing I want to hear. But I said, yes, I'm Omar, the doctor who has a personality and not like a TV personality. And she joked, and she turns out she was a radiology consultant who has a startup, a tele radiology startup.
Okay.
She left medicine, left the NHS. Well, they need medicine, but left the NHS to go and do this. She's a CEO, co-founder, very dynamic young woman. She said to me, what do you think about bringing kids from Gaza to the UK to help them if they need help? And I said, wow, I was literally just thinking the same thing the other day, but I didn't know how to approach it. She goes, okay, do you want me to take that off your plate?
Oh, wow.
That's literally what she said. Because I'd sort of had thoughts about it and started trying to make some connections. So I was like, yes, please. And, you know, that has led to us now in a situation where we are, and I can't talk about it in too much detail because it's politically sensitive, but we are at a stage where we could potentially be thinking in the next couple months to bring some children across, a bit like in Ukraine, to bring them and treat them here if needed with their families, if required. And then, and that has like, that has been literally me just being there, like to talk to, but not to actually do anything. So, so that is a reality. There is a lot of moving parts, but a lot of it is down to a huge amount of effort by volunteers, by team players, by people around me who are doing this and they don't want any credit. And that's the key thing is these people, if their intentions are, we want to help Palestine, we want to help Gaza, we want to help humanity, then they are able to achieve these things. It's like if there's any self-interest in any of these situations, it will unmask itself and it will be seen and you will be exposed, because that is just not the way to like run something like this, which is so pure. It really is coming from people, health workers, wanting to just make their voices heard and make the voices of Gazans heard. It's not making their voice heard. It's amplifying the voices of people in Gaza who are being silenced, the children of Gaza who are being silenced, the human beings in Gaza who are being silenced, because no one should be silenced.
Yeah.
And they are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They are, I would say they are superhuman beings.
Yeah.
They are, really are, because I don't think any other nation on earth, any other people would have tolerated what they have tolerated and yet would smile and say, Alhamdulillah, or, you know, kind of when you pick up the phone and call them, they don't even, they just like, we can't complain, like, yeah. Alhamdulillah.
At least we're alive sort of situation, which is tragic in and of itself. I mean, your description of what you went through in terms of your, you know, having these bouts maybe throughout your teen years of kind of low level depression, anxiety, this reminds me exactly of me, of how my teens and 20s were, how I was doing so much.
Yeah.
I always felt a little bit these things in the background, but they'd last, it'd be like you said, like a cloud, a few weeks and it would go, and then I would just trundle along, manage it, it was fine. And again, anxiety was more, I looked at it as being just hyper and really active. Until you do eventually hit a wall and the burnout comes. And in my case, it wasn't that I'd taken on too much, it was just a big life change. And I think when I sort of stopped for a moment, or I landed, as I say, and I've described this in previous episodes of this podcast, when I kind of returned to London after many years abroad, it sort of all caught up with me. And yeah. Then I had to go on this journey, and it was a long journey, and it's, you know, but a good one in the end, because I'm much better for it and I can see the triggers, and obviously doing this podcast because I want to talk more about it so that people realize actually how it comes to anyone at any time. And it's actually not a measure of your success or achievements or lack thereof. Sure. Not that I want to boast myself, but obviously you're a very accomplished man. I've also accomplished many things in my life. It's not for lack of intelligence or smarts or any of that, or even ambition. But I do think though, it can come, I mean, everyone's case is unique, but often over caring without self-caring is, I think, a big key lesson that I've had to learn. And it's also been really relevant now, right? Because so much of what is happening in your life, but in mine, but in many others, is about this outpouring of care, of love. And you want to give and you want to do, but it's also about understanding how can you do this while it being sustainable? How can you giving yourself even permission, because for some people they may not even be giving themselves permission to even say, hey, you know what, it's a bit much for me right now, I can't take it, I need to take a step away. I'm so happy to hear that you're like, I'm fortified by these people and I have these, you know, colleagues, or I have those who are helping me. However, I kind of want to ask you about maybe the slightly darker side. Maybe you're not experiencing it, but from what I've heard from many people, you know, as this sort of fracturing of humanity as we are seeing it now is bringing up a lot of trauma, yes, but it's also for many kind of bringing about a lot of despondency and despair, right? Like, how can this be happening? Mm-hmm. What is the world coming to? How could this be? Do you face that? Has anyone in your work, is that lingering at all? How do you fight it? Is that actually not related to what is happening and more an individual thing? What do you think?
I think it's a really very tricky one, because I guess we are in the team, I say we, the team, the health workers of Palestine, this grassroots movement, we are so entrenched in like our weekly tasks are all about like getting this vigil sorted, like getting the speakers, like being there, maintaining that momentum, sending out the press release, like speaking to the right people, approaching, you know, so there is, and these are across literally 30 cities in the UK and 30 cities in the world. So it's no small like undertaking. And I think being that busy and being so like almost, it's almost like tunnel vision, yeah, where you don't have time to despair. So you have time and you have periods where you think, is this really like changing the needle?
Yeah.
Is what I'm and what we are doing actually resulting in any less deaths in Gaza? And I've asked myself that question, and the short, horrible, brutal answer is no, it's not. it's not having effect on the 20,000 deaths that have happened. They would have happened had I, you know, not decided to rock up at 10 Downing Street on the 10th of November, or had I don't think there would have been a iota of difference in terms of like what actually has happened on the ground. Now, having said that, and this is where it's important, the small wins and the small gains are the things that I'm seeing, which remove me from that despondency or like feeling of like, what's the point? Who cares? Like, no one actually cares, right? So I'll give you an example. So I have a very good friend of mine, and I'm sure she doesn't mind me sharing this. I don't have to reveal who she is, but she was a doctor who worked with me throughout my training. We did a lot of shifts together. She's now a consultant, a children's doctor in London, and she comes from the Black community. She's not Muslim. She's not Arab. She's not Palestinian. She doesn't even know the history of Israel-Palestine. Like, in no way, shape, or form. It's all like, you know, what she's read on the news. So very early on when this happened, she reached out to me and said, like, are you okay? Because I can imagine you know people in Gaza. I know you've been there. And I said, I'm not okay. Like, frankly, I think I responded, and I think actually, thinking back, it was a pretty like brutal way to respond. I sent her a video of like some kid being killed or something like horrific, and I was like, no, I'm not fucking okay. Like, it was like that, you know? And this is someone who's actually reaching out and being caring. So that was a mistake. I learned from that, but that was fine. She took it on the chin and she understood like where I was coming from. And she said to me, like, her initial response was, I'm not educated on this. I have no idea what's going on. All I can tell you is, like, this is horrific, but I really don't want to take sides. And she was very neutral about it, and didn't want to engage in like what is happening, right? So I was too busy to kind of like think about it. And then a few weeks passed, and then she messaged me and said, I saw you were doing a vigil. What happens? Like, am I allowed to come? And I was like, of course, anyone's welcome. So she came once. Again, I said hi to her. It was very like, you know, superficial conversation. And then the day that we had on the 16th of November, sorry, 16th of December, on the Saturday, we had a 5,000 person silent procession from 10 down, from St. Thomas's Hospital to 10 Downing Street, led by Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, the famous plastic surgeon who came out of Gaza under fire, led by Hossam Zomlotar, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. And she came, and I saw her, and she came and hugged me and said, you know, that was really moving. And then she followed it up with a text message, and she wrote this long message that was basically like saying the journey that she has gone through. And she told me, I was actually too scared to speak up at work about the situation, because I have so many Jewish colleagues and so many Israeli colleagues who are like so adamant that they are being exterminated. And I'm like too scared to say anything because I feel like I'll be shot down. And her words were, your team has given us has broken that fear barrier. I'm now very able to go and tell people to shove it if they come and tell me, like, you know, Gaza is an existentialist threat to Israel.
That's like, huge.
And she basically said she is happy to openly talk about it. Wow. And like I said, this is someone who's not from the Arab community, not from the Muslim community, not from the Christian, you know, the Palestinian Christian community. She is a Black African British doctor of no affiliation to Palestine, apart from the shared humanity.
Wow.
So
what a huge, that's huge work. And that's just one story, you know. You may not, there may be hundreds of others, I'm sure there are, who have been equally impacted, which is incredible. So yeah, it is having an impact, even if these, you know, the immediate, what we all want really, which is a ceasefire, is not currently in place. And fingers crossed by the time this airs, it will be.
Sure.
But yes, in terms of looking at this as more, which you told me before, you know, a marathon, not a sprint, you get to see better results. But also, I wonder, and I mean, from my own readings on mental health and self-development and the like, you know, purpose, having a sense of purpose is a really big part of being able to sort of get out of that dark tunnel. Sure. I mean, for you, it's a dark cloud. I call it a dark tunnel. In any event, all of those feelings are quite dark. But what gets me out of it, even if it's sort of short term, not so much like a clinical issue, but just like a mood thing or a longer term one, is this idea of purpose, but not just any purpose, like a purpose you're aligned with, right? It's almost like when you're doing something that you really, you just know really, this is where I'm meant to be. This is who I'm meant to be. do, it's not only meant to, it's like you really want to.
Yeah.
It's not really even a question.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, I'm present for this. And then I don't know if that's how you feel, but I feel like it just kind of, it comes with a particular energy that is sort of protective and kind of pushes you forward.
It's like a, it's like the you know, what's it called in the comic books or the superhero movies? It's like the dome, the shield.
Basically. The shield, yeah. Exactly. Like the shield.
It is the shield for sure. Like I'm just imagining one of those comic books, but it literally is. And this comes back to the question about burnout and the question about purpose, because I realize now that part of the reason that I was burning out is that I did not have a sense of purpose. I was doing a PhD, a very academic PhD on like imaging biomarkers in pediatric multiple sclerosis. I mean, it's so niche.
Mm.
It's so niche. And it's important. And it's important work because it's, you know, hopefully it will have some impact on children with multiple sclerosis.
Mm.
And I do not, that, like I said, that is primarily my identity. I'm a children's doctor who looks after children with brain disease and MS and other conditions. But at that time, I was losing that sense of purpose. Like, where is the light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah.
What am I actually achieving? What am I going to do with this? Like, am I just doing this for the sake of publishing? Am I doing this for, like, how is this actually going to have an impact? And it's very difficult in academia, unless you're a hardcore scientist, to actually see that impact or envision it or, like, you know, manifest it. It's just very difficult to have that. So in a way, Gaza and the situation in Gaza gave me suddenly that sense of purpose of this just feels like literally almost like my calling and I have to do this. And what I say in this, like, this is an honest truth. You can ask my wife, you can ask my parents. I am not a public speaker.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot, I hate, there is nothing more, there is nothing I hate more than public speaking.
Wow.
I remember as a child, anxiety beyond anxiety about the idea of picking up the phone. So I would hate answering the phone at home at the age of 14 to, like, you know, I would be embarrassed by the idea of I have to answer the phone. I would hate the idea of debating. I would hate the idea of having to make a speech. I hated presentations. Like, so I had to train myself for interviews. For example, when you apply for medical school, you have to be interviewed at the age of 18, which many other degrees don't make you do. So you have to have that and you have to kind of work on it. So medicine helps because you're exposed to people. You have to talk. You have to, like, be able to present in, you know, in a ward round, etc. But that was never my strength and never my like thing. And I would always need to be prepared. I need, like, my notes. I need things on paper. I can't just, like, do it off the cuff. It just cannot be done like that for me. And it's like Gaza came and it just unleashed this, like, sudden ability to just speak the truth. And that is what it is. It's, you know, that Jesus said, I think, quote, like, speak the truth and the truth sets you free.
Yeah.
I heard this from Azizuddin Abu Lish, actually, a dear friend of mine, a Ghazan obstetrician whose daughters all died. Three of his daughters died in the 2008-09 attacks. And then 35 members of his family have been annihilated since. And he said this, and it's true. It's the truth sets you free. And it's like, I am seeing something and it is so unjust. It is so awful and it is so horrific that, and I am someone with a platform who has been to this place, who knows these people, who can humanize them. So if I do not stand up and speak, then who the hell will? And if I don't, and this is like my thought process, and this happened in a very short space of time, and you shared that with me because that was the time when the hospital got bombed at Ahli Hospital. We were on the phone together. Yeah. You were the first person I spoke to when that happened, and, like, we shared that, like, that pain and that anguish.
Yeah.
And that same night, waking up in the morning, the first thought was, I have to speak about this and I have to talk about it and I have to shout about it and I will not stop. And if I do not do this, I'm complicit in the murder of every Ghazan that is being massacred en masse. That was my feeling. And it sounds, people are like, that's a bit, like, dramatic, dude, like, chill out. Like, you're not actually, like, shooting them down or bombing the hell out of them. But, like, it is. It's like, if you're, you know, like, I guess from our religion, I'm religious, like, I'm Muslim, I'm practicing, like, you know, for me, like, you know, the Prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon him, like, he was always a truth seeker and he was someone who spoke the truth. He was known as a truthful one, even before, like, the revelation came. Like, he was someone who people like identified with him as a truth seeker. So, you know, that is so important. And part of my identity is like, in this situation, you have to talk the truth. You have to speak the truth. And if you don't, then you are either at best misjudged and at worst complicit.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear you on all of those fronts. I think that idea of just arriving at a moment of acute clarity about where, what you have to do. You know, I think a lot of those questions we grapple with, and then, yeah, a moment arrives, and there are different moments along our lives, but this one is definitely one of those. And it's incredible that the transformation that you described from someone who was like, no, I'm absolutely not going anywhere public, to now very much so, and doing it so well. I mean, just with such incredible honesty, but also compassion and clarity. It's really, wow, like, look at that. And I think that speaks a lot to sort of purpose and drive. I want to ask, within the profession, have you encountered now any difficulties with what it is that you're doing, and how have you faced that, if so?
Yeah, so I think the simple answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
The more nuanced answer is that is as a result of essentially, you know, people that I'm close to who are Israeli, and they have family that have been affected by the 7th of October attacks.
Mm.
In fact, I have a very dear colleague of mine who's a senior to me, someone I very much respect, whose family, unfortunately, were being held hostage in Gaza. Some of them were released, and I think one is still, unfortunately, an elderly man is still being held hostage. Mm. We don't know his whereabouts or what's happened with him. And that's clearly created tension, and that has, you know, made it very difficult. The one saving grace, I guess, for me is that because I'm doing my PhD and I'm not actually on the hospital site, so I don't actually have to, in some ways, I'm not affiliated to that hospital, okay, like right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, no one's picked up the phone to me and said, like, you know, like, you're representing the hospital, so can you stop doing that? Because, yeah, and I don't, like, when I go on TV, I'm very clear, do not mention my hospital, do not mention my university. You can call me from Health Workers Palestine,
yeah,
a doctor. I'm speaking on behalf of Omar Abdelmin. I'm not speaking on behalf of this hospital, that university, or whatever it is. So that's been challenging. The other challenge I've found is colleagues and basically fear of repercussion about speaking up.
Yeah.
And I think within the medical profession, so medical professionals by nature are quite cautious people, maybe not as cautious as lawyers or, you know, but we're pretty cautious. So for them to, like, you know, there's always this thing about about medicine should be apolitical, should be nonpartisan, etc. So as soon as you get into Gaza, Gaza is so politicized. Unfortunately, and that's the reality, the Palestinian issue, the occupation of 75 years, is the most politically charged topic of our lifetime and many of our previous generations. So for them to even consider to, like, talk about it, they worry that this will aggravate their Israeli Jewish or British Jewish colleagues, or it will lead to repercussions in terms of employment. And I know this, like, I can tell you for sure, I know cases in the UK, but much more so in North America, of doctors who have been, like, literally sacked from their job because of speaking up or tweeting or putting on Instagram. People have been reported to the General Medical Council.
Yeah.
The head of the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health, an excellent pediatrician of the, like, utmost humanity, and I know her personally, she came out and made a statement about Gaza, which was very, very balanced.
Yeah.
It did not give any weight to anyone. It just said children are disproportionately affected and they should not be.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
And people reported her for being anti-Semitic.
Wow.
Right? Like, people called up the General Medical Council and said, we are reporting this person for being an anti-Semite because she is siding with Gaza, because, you know, by taking it. So you can see, like, the fear factor. And I'm speaking to one of her colleagues, as she told me, like, she has faced so much vitriol, so many death threats, so much hatred just from, like, this one letter, which, of all the Royal Colleges, kudos to her, was the one that actually addressed Gaza. All the others just, like, pretend like Gaza didn't even exist, or didn't say anything.
Wow.
No? Like the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of, the Royal College of General practitioners and nursing have both come out and called for a ceasefire.
Okay.
Very early on. So to be fair to them, they were pretty hot on this from quite early on. The people who are most affected, I actually think, are the medical students. And the medical students that I've seen and talked to are so fearful of their own universities, like either kicking them out or like censoring them, to the point that I'll give you an example. We were invited, myself and Nick Maynard, a colleague of mine, to go and speak at Cambridge University in the Medical Student Society. And we were told we were not allowed to call for a ceasefire. Wow. And when I said to them why, they said, because it is political. I said, I'm sorry, it is not political. This is a humanitarian like phrase, like ceasefire is not a politically charged word.
Yeah.
And then I said, so what's the actual issue? So they said, we've been advised that it could be interpreted as anti-Semitic to call for a ceasefire. And this is the, like, this is a challenge within the medical profession, within every sector of life. So you see in journalism, a very good friend of mine who's been helping me with, prepping me for these interviews from day one, a very, very intelligent, active journalist, producer, writer, has literally been censored since day one because she started putting stuff on Instagram about Gaza. She can't get work. She's a freelancer. She literally can't get commissioned. No one wants to go near her from the BBC, etc. And this is probably one of our best talents in journalism in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is very shocking. It's incredibly worrying. I mean, the idea, the notion that just in any context saying stop the war, stop any killing, should then be seen as prejudicial against any people is absurd, let me put it frankly. And within that absurdity, though, is what I also worry about is the impact that this is having on individuals, like mentally, emotionally. You know, you get your doctor doing your job, caring for people, you then go out and ask for more care to be spread in the world, and then your job is on the line. You know, you are not only... are you reported to your bosses for doing something wrong, but you're also like giving this late, like charged with something incredibly, I mean, incredibly bad and unacceptable to be anti-Semitic, unacceptable to be prejudiced against anyone, really is unacceptable to be racist in that way. So that impact is also like a huge one, to a huge burden that people are taking on and possibly taking on silently. Because, you know, yes, you know of some cases, I know of some cases, we hear about some cases, but I'm sure there are many other cases in which they're just having to deal with this alone. And I worry definitely for those people. But I kind of want to ask you in relation to that, but also tying it in with the fact that we both know, I mean, you more than even I, but within the medical profession, there are very high rates already of mental imbalance, let's call it, or mental illness, whether it's diagnosed, or, you know, high rates of burnout, high rates of suicide. When I was prepping to for this, to find out, it's between 2 to 5 times more than the national average by occupation. That is that doctors commit suicide 2 to 5 times the rate of the average. As you said, addictions to alcohol, narcotics, etc., very high, multiple times higher than, again, the average. And it strikes me as, like, I'm going to put it really basically, but, like, that's mad. It's insane.
People who look after you can't even look after themselves. Look at
the people who we give all of this authority to look after us are basically falling apart at the seams and no one's looking after them.
Yeah.
And
I couldn't put it better. That's exactly what it is. I think the medical profession, by nature, I think people are likely to, when they go into the medical profession, because of what they are exposed to. So by nature, you're going to be at more risk of suffering depression, suffering from anxiety, suffering from, you know, self-harm, suicide, etc. That there is that risk, like, it can happen. Now, I think the link to this, I would say, so I think what I want to say is basically it is all about what are the systems in place that are protecting you from that increased risk, right? Yeah. So there's a threshold. Like, you are, let's say that's the threshold and the average population is here and the medics are here. What pushes you above that clinical threshold where you are actually suffering from clinical depression as a medic? Now, I would say it is the systematic, it is the systems in place around you. So the NHS is crumbling. Like, there is no doubt the NHS is failing, and you know, for many purposes, whether it's mismanagement, poor funding, like patient pressures, like, you know, staff shortages, brain drain, people, exodus of doctors to like Australia and North America and wherever in Europe. That is happening. So that is putting an additional burden on these doctors who are sitting there, like, you know, like sitting ducks basically. And then they go above that threshold because basically they are working ridiculous shifts. They are service providers. They're not even getting time to learn or train or do what they actually enjoy. They forget the love of the art of medicine and they just like work like monkeys, or they feel like, I'm going to work, I start at 8, I finish at 7, and like I've still got these jobs that I haven't done and I have to hand them over. It's just like a cycle of like, you know, the rat race, and it's the worst kind of rat race because it's just destructive. So for sure, and I've seen this. So the other thing I noticed through my own journey is when I reached out to colleagues and friends, and initially I was very like protective of revealing anything about my mental health to anyone.
Yeah.
Like it was because, like, you know this as an Arab, you know, like there is a stigma to it. Like if you go and, you know, and I grew up this because within my own family there was depression and no one talked about it. There's a lot of machoism about like, you know, like stiff upper lip essentially, or like, you know, grow a pair and like be strong and be the man and look after your women and that nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. So there is that ingrained within us, I think, and even in my generation, the way we maybe were brought up in the Middle East and the way our parents kind of were brought up as well. So I think I realized very quickly when I spoke out to people and people who I could confide in, that actually almost everyone I know, like who was high functioning, had suffered some sort of mental health issue, whether it was subclinical or clinical or, you know, something completely different, but it's so rife and common.
Yeah.
And that's not right. It shouldn't be the case. But it's a reflection of the society that we live in, and it's a reflection of the profession that we are working within.
Mm.
So that profession being medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why doctors are striking like crazy, because they are earning peanuts compared to what they should be earning. And the nurses are even worse. The nurses are like, you know, doing horrifically tasking, you know, demanding work, and they are being compensated with like peanuts. When you look at the corporate world and when you look at it, it just seems unfair.
Mm.
So, you know, people, I guess, I don't know, like I'm not in that world, but I imagine people who are like working at very high levels within corporate law, within, I don't know, like accounting or like a tech, who are working their asses off, but being compensated accordingly, I imagine they are less at risk of mental health illness compared to someone who's working their ass off but not being compensated.
I mean, it's a factor for sure. Like how you are treated, and part of that treatment is how you are remunerated, as well as other factors. I mean, if you are treated horrendously but paid loads of money, that isn't necessarily going to, you know, square things. But it is one element of the overall treatment, and also the value that is placed on you, which then trickles down into the value you place on yourself and so on. And so forth. But it's obviously a big issue within the medical profession. One that, do you see any improvements in?
I think our generation is very attuned to it, and I think we talk about it very openly. And I think, for example, there's very much less judgment about, like, I've seen colleagues take time off work. When I took time off work, no one, like some people knew, like my boss and my direct friends, but many people didn't. And maybe people assumed, or maybe they didn't, but no one ever, like, I never was made to feel like, it felt like as if I'd gone and had an operation, right?
Yeah.
And that's what it should be. Like, it should be your mental health and your physical health, whether you're sick, like, because you're depressed, or you're sick because you've had an injury, like, it shouldn't be treated differently. Like, these are protected characteristics. And I think, actually, I would say in the space that I'm in, it has been fine. I think some professions like surgeons, and some of the research I know you did, because I think I discussed it with you, was the surgeon in the US who was talking about the rates of suicide within surgeons, and it was ridiculous. Like it was, because these guys in the US, they are so militant. They work like 100-hour weeks often, and they are just in the hospital day in, day out, no respite, no time to like breathe. And so some specialties for sure are by nature quite you know, like macho, and it's all about just work. And I think in those spaces that are probably more male dominated, I think there is less space for that.
Yeah.
In pediatrics and child health, 80% of the workforce is female.
Yeah.
So there is that, like, more empathy, sympathy, the things that, you know, that just come hand in hand with that. And I think that helps.
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned that, and about when you little bit culturally, this the stigma and the shame in terms of, you know, from sort of Egyptian Arab culture around mental health. I'd also argue that it wasn't so different even here up until recent, like mm-hmm. 2 decades ago, people mm-hmm. were the same, very, let's not talk about it, and stiff yeah. upper lip, just maybe with a slightly different tinge to it. Would you say that having that aspect of your culture, or perhaps opening it up more to you, what aspect of your cultural background do you think kind of worked against you when it came to your mental health, or limits you, or has historically limited you, maybe?
So I think that upbringing within not being given the space, or not, oh, for example, like I said, if there was mental health issues in the family or people that you knew, not discussing it openly, you know, and actually hiding it from your kids, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, and I very reflect, I'm a father, I have a 7-year-old daughter, and I'm very aware of that. So I'm very aware that actually, you know, as my daughter grows up and she sees, you know, like, I mean, it's funny, I say that, and this is typical, like you think, oh, I know best, and, you know, my parents did this wrong, and then you do the same shit. Like, it just happens. It's, yeah, so, it you know, during this time when I was not very well, we hid it from yeah. my daughter very much. So, like, and I guess she's young, it's a bit difficult. Had she been like 12 or 13, maybe yeah. it would have been a bit different. But I hope that at least, like, with her, I can use that learning of, like, actually suppressing stuff is not helpful
yeah.
and open it up so that she feels safe to be able to, like, you know, talk about her mental mm-hmm. health and be able to, like, understand that, you know, her feelings are, she has to be like in tune with her feelings and yeah. able to express it. So I think definitely that cultural macho, like, Arab man thing that is, like, you know, brought up as you grow up, and it's like you still hear it. You hear, like, you know, the man of the house, and that, you know, he has to look after the women, and it's that mm-hmm. it's that sort of sexist, essentially, very old school way of thinking. I think that has potentially, maybe, for example, let's say I was, I don't know, brought up in Norway, I don't know, yeah. somewhere where maybe they were a bit more open about it earlier. Yeah. Maybe had I experienced those subclinical depressive periods in my teens, I would have been more open about it
yeah.
and able to seek help earlier mm. rather than wait till, like, you know, shit hit the fan.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but in fairness, I mean, on here in the UK, these conversations true. Have only really even been opening up in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years, yeah. Really, really big in a big way. So, but still, absolutely, your own background, even, and it's also about what happens in the home, and
that's also what you're exposed to on TV.
What you're exposed to on
TV. So, like, I don't remember any, you know, like, think back to the stuff you watched on TV, like in your, I don't know, I watched like Temsiliyat. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. soap, Arabic soaps. So,
yeah.
I don't remember anything about mental health being no. discussed. But now, like, for example, if I turn on the TV, it's nothing yeah. but mental health.
Yeah.
So, like, one thing that I found very, like, therapeutic for me throughout this is actually watching podcasts like The Secret Diary of a CEO
yeah.
or Louis Theroux, who talks very openly about this stuff.
Yes.
And he talks to celebrities, people who you're like, oh, this, you know, this person, you look up to them, you know, someone like Stormzy or someone like Bear Grylls, and yeah. they talk about it very openly, and they're yeah. like, I've been through this.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, wow. I mean, if Bear Grylls has been through it, like,
I'm so fine. Cool, yeah.
You know? Right.
Yeah. yeah. The flip side to that question is what helps you? What do you take from your culture that you think does fortify your mental and emotional stability?
I think by nature, as Arabs and Middle Easterners and yeah. Mediterraneans, we are very sociable people.
Yeah.
And we love to eat together. We love to, like, spend time together. And also actually that the thing about the kind of, you know, my best friends in the UK, you know, not by choice, but just that's the way it's happened, are all Egyptians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are mixed. So some of them are, like, born and raised here. Some of them have come in their 20s. Some have come in their 30s. So I have the whole spectrum and the people like with, you know, very little cultural baggage and some with like loads of cultural baggage. So like I find it very therapeutic when I go out and they're all my male friends
yeah.
and we just hang out, we go out for a shisha, mm-hmm. we go out and like, you know, sit and talk and having that and you kind of, maybe you don't talk about it directly, you're not yeah. like, but you kind of do talk about how you feel and actually now even within that group of like 30, 40-year-old Arab Egyptian men, friends of mine, they are very open and we are able to discuss these things or at least check on each other. And many of us, like, you know, many of them have been through very difficult life circumstances. One went through stage 3 leukemia. Two of them went through horrible divorces. So at least like having that support network and that structure is very important. I think the other thing is the importance of the family unit. And I think like we are, again, extremely tied to our parents, our siblings, our children. We are just by nature, like we hold on to our family. We don't like the idea of, you know, what unfortunately I think has happened in the West and in the Western world is this individualism that has reached a level where you should self-care to the point and self-love to the point that you only give a crap about yourself.
Yeah.
And that is very dangerous. I think there is a balance. You have to be able to look after yourself, but you also have to care for others and you have to have that balance. And that is where I think actually we are at an advantage over people here who are born and bred here, because they are in such, unfortunately, a society that values the self almost above the community. I would say that links to what is happening in Gaza. Because if you think about it, when you become so engrossed about your own crap, then you stop caring about the crap of others. So you actually look at Gaza and they've been dehumanized for decades. Mm-hmm. And then it's easy to be like, well, you know, I've got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah.
You know, I've got like family, I've got food bills. And I've heard this stuff. I've heard like, oh, I'd love to speak up about it, but you know, like, you know, I've got stuff. I've got my own stuff going on.
Yeah.
And sure, like you do have your own stuff going on, fair enough. But there is a risk when that happens in mass.
Yeah.
And like a whole population of a silent majority that just don't want to speak up and are too scared to speak up.
Yeah.
Then no change will happen.
Yeah.
Like it will just become a static, stagnant society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that breakdown of community that is breaking us apart. But it's also, and kind of, again, to tie back to what you were saying now, you brought it up. From a cultural perspective, absolutely, it's true within Middle Eastern culture, it is very, very like together and sociable. Mm-hmm. But also within the work that you're doing, because you repeatedly mentioned the humanitarian work you're doing with Gaza Medic Voices and healthcare workers for Palestine, constantly brought up how there's a team, there's a group, there's camaraderie, there's
the people
you're not alone, you're doing it together. And that, you know, and link that to what you're saying about also culturally and your friends. And I think back of myself and what has gotten me through, it's that community, that sense that I'm not alone with others, all of that sort of dynamic but caring energy, collective. And it absolutely does, it does build you up, but it also, you then recognize that without it, how vulnerable we really all are. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ahmed, so much for spending this hour with me talking, sharing and opening up.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
Learning more about you, learning more about the work that you do, but also just your goals, your passions. So thank you very much. And yeah, I look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you so much, Ahmed.
Yeah.
Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast. Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, leilamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.